Thanks, Larry, and thank you all for being here on a beautiful Sunday morning. You can't hear me? Is the mic on? Yeah? Can you hear me now? Is that better?
No.
No? Can you hear me now? No. All right. We've got to use the mic. Hold on. Is that better?
Yeah.
Now everybody can hear me? Okay. Now I can hear. All right. Good. So welcome, and thank you again for being here. Before I begin, I just want to make sure everyone has a handout, and if you don't, if you're sitting up there and you don't have one, please come get one. Oh, good, because we are going to definitely be using it, and also you're going to need something to write with. And we have a few extra pencils and pens floating around. Just to continue, I am the... continue with just a brief introduction. I'm a professor of archaeology and anthropology here at Yeshiva University, and also, and as part of that, I should say, you may not know this, but Yeshiva University, we actually also take our students on an archaeological excavation every summer. We've been working at Tel Tzafi, which is the biblical city of Gath, which is Goliath's hometown, since 2004. Now, as I said that, we take the students, but we also take other volunteers. So if anybody else here is interested in participating in an archaeological excavation, please feel free to contact me, and we'll rope you in. All right, so that being said, the goal for today is, first of all, I'll thank Rabbi Brander for sort of warming you up archaeologically, and the goal for today is we are going to learn about a little bit about the origins of the alphabet, and we're going to look at a very early alphabetic text from the 10th century BCE that was found in the land of Israel. We will compare that to the letters from the Gezer calendar, and then we're going to spend the rest of the time, you are going to actually read the Gezer calendar, so that's why you need your pens, because you'll have the ancient letters in front of you, and you're going to have the real text of the Gezer calendar, and you're going to try to figure it out. Then we will translate it together, and that should do it for today. Okay, so briefly about the alphabet. In the ancient world, the Egyptians and the Sumerians, and then followed by the Akkadians, had developed writing systems by 3000 BCE. Okay, so the first writing systems were in use 5000 years ago. These were writing systems that worked. It took about 7, 8, 10 years of scribal training in order to really master them. But once you had mastered them, you sort of had a job for life. So there was no incentive to make the process any easier for other people. And as a result, while the societies were indeed literate, it meant literacy was quite low because they were very difficult systems to master. They were basically built, they had logograms where a sign would stand for a particular word. They also was, but mostly it functioned as syllabaries where it was syllabic. So you had a sign that stood for a syllable. In the case of cuneiform, it was either a consonant and a vowel, or it could be consonant, vowel, consonant. And then to make things more confusing, a lot of times the signs had multiple sounds, multiple sort of phonemes, that had absolutely nothing to do with each other. So it really did take a lot of practice in order to learn how to use these systems. And in order to communicate internationally, if you were going to a place, say, that didn't have a tradition of literacy, it meant that scribes had to be sent to the foreign land in order to then carry on the communication. So that started about 5,000 years ago. About a little less than 3,000 years ago, by this time, it was a well-established practice in Egypt that when they were writing foreign words, and if you're writing in Egyptian hieroglyphs, many of the foreign words you were actually writing were Semitic words because that was the closest neighbor to the north, the Egyptians developed basically a type of alphabet, which was they used what's called an acrophonic principle, which is how the alphabet works, right? Where the first sound of the letter is the sound that it makes. And they used this to write out foreign, and as I said, mostly Semitic words. They never took it beyond that. They never applied that to their own language. too Egyptian, but they did develop this principle. So it, probably somebody, a Semitic speaker, became familiar with this, and it seems that our earliest examples are about 1700 BCE, so about 3,700 years ago. We have examples where and it could be the work of a single person in the land of Israel, basically took this idea of the acrophonic principle that the Egyptians had for writing Semitic words and decided to use the sounds and the names of Semitic words, Canaanite words, to create an alphabet. Okay, and that is the origin of our alphabet. The alphabet was invented, we know, at least twice, two different alphabets. There was another one that was at Ugarit, which was in Lebanon today. That alphabet actually did not kind of spawn any descendants, whereas the original Canaanite alphabet, of which we'll see the Hebrew alphabet descends from, is actually the sole source of every alphabet in use today. And I always, in students, I say that, and the students are like, no way. And so then they say, what about the Hindi alphabet or whatever? And then they see that it goes back to, you know, eventually it'll go back to the Greek alphabet. Okay, well, the Greek alphabet, of course, comes from the Phoenician alphabet, which is the Canaanite alphabet. So it all goes back to this single alphabet. And what made the system so beautiful and so perfect was that with basically 22, or maybe originally there were 23 letters, with these 22 letters, you could kind of sound out any word, any Semitic word. And what this meant then, and they wrote without vowels, as you're familiar with today, and what this meant then was that literacy was something that ultimately could become quite widespread. Because any of you who are in the education field, you know that you can take a six-year-old, and you know, an average six-year-old, and within 6 months you can teach that child to read something, you know, phonetically, something very basic. And so that just is going to revolutionize everything. Okay, so that's just a little bit about the origins of the alphabet. Now, specifically, sometimes early on, it's difficult to tell whether something's written in Canaanite or something's written in Hebrew or some other West Semitic languages that are all very, very closely related, such as Aramaic, Moabite, Ammonite, even Edomite. So these are all what we would consider West Semitic languages as opposed to East Semitic languages like Arabic or Akkadian. So they start off very, very closely related, and then over time, we'll start to see differences in the writing of the letters, and also there are differences even in diction and vocabulary. So sometimes we can tell it's a Hebrew inscription because of the way they use certain verbs or something. One final note, the letters that you're going to look at today, this is known as the Ketav Ivri, which is the ancient, you know, Israelite script. This is the first, this is the script that we find in the first temple period. So the question arises about what can archaeology tell us about the Ketav Ashuri, which is the script that we're used to reading today. So the Ketav Ashuri, it's actually a very interesting story too, so I might as well tell it because it's a great story, which is when the Assyrians started to conquer towards the west, and they were heading towards the Mediterranean. So we're talking in the 9th century BCE. The Assyrians wrote in Akkadian. And in fact, if you ever study Akkadian, if you go to a university to study Akkadian, which is kind of a crazy thing to do, which I did at some point and have basically forgotten everything. But if you study Akkadian, the letters that they teach you, the first signs that they teach you will be the Neo-Assyrian script, because it's sort of the simplest, the clearest, and there's an abundance of texts. So anyway, so the Assyrians were very much interested in building an empire, and having an empire that was well-managed, that was efficient, that was economically, you know, productive. And one of the things they recognized, of course, is that you have to have efficient communication if you want to run an empire. And again, the limitations of Akkadian is that it's so difficult to learn how to write it. And as they're moving westward, they come into contact with Aram. Aram is the ancient seat of Aram is Damascus. So that's the first kind of West Semitic people they encounter. And they realize, oh, the Arameans have this really great writing system, which is an alphabet. And so it's at that juncture, it's the Assyrians then, they make this decision, which will have ramifications later on, which is that they are going to adopt Aramaic as the language of the empire. And the reason they adopt it is because it's written in an alphabet. They don't think that to write Akkadian in the alphabet, because by this time there's such a tradition, I mean, that has to be written in Akkadian, so they adopt Aramaic. And then in order to kind of standardize it and to make it easier to read, they sort of change the font of the letters. And that's the Ketav Ashuri. So the Ketav Ashuri, excuse me, the Ketav Ashuri, those are the same Hebrew letters, the Canaanite letters, the Aramaic letters. They've just changed the font. They've made them more blocky, which makes it easier to read. And subsequently, it's really then the Persians later on, they continue this practice. And it's during the Persian period then that the Ketav Ashuri is brought back to the land of Israel, traditionally with, you know, Ezra the scribe, and that's when you start having Hebrew being written in the Ketav Ashuri, although the Jews will still remember the Ketav Ivri, and they'll write with it sometimes for nationalistic purposes, so sometimes on like the Bar Kokhba coins or on the coins of the Hashmonaim, they'll still have a little bit of the Ketav Ivri. I mean, we know even in the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a few instances where the name of Hashem is written in the Ketav Ivri as opposed to the Ketav Ashuri. But nevertheless, that's how the transition takes place. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Ketav Ivri, though, which is going to take us back to First Temple period. All right, so we're going to start now with the alphabetic inscription. And that is on your on page one, I guess, you know, once you get past the title page. Okay, and this is from, this alphabetic inscription is from a site called Tel Zait. And if you look on the map, you can see it here. The map is, it's, you can see it doesn't, you know, it's only covers about, I don't know, 60 kilometers wide. Oh, thank you. Let me grab it. And if you look carefully here, one of the things you'll notice, remember, we're going back to First Temple times, to the early part of the First Temple, right around, right after the time of King David, okay? So the land of Israel, you have the, in the land of Israel, you have the kingdom of Israel, later it'll be Israel and Judah, but they're in the highlands, and then you have Philistia, that's in the coast, and then part of the coastal plain. And the site of Tel Zait, we'll see, is also in that coastal plain. It's kind of right a border region site. And then, of course, you can see Gezer further to the north. So, you know, if you look on the coast, you see Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod. Those are all Philistine sites. And then where you see it says Mikne Ekron and Tzafi Gat. By the way, that's where the YU dig is at Tzafi Gat. You can see that that is also part of Philistia. That's the heart, you know, there you have kind of the border regions of Philistia. And then you have this kind of small site of Tel Zait, right south of Gath. And it was, it's one of those sites that may originally have been in the Philistine kind of sphere of influence, and then subsequently shifts over into the, into a Judahite sphere of influence. It's a rather small site. Which makes it even more interesting that you have writing there, because usually it's, you know, small sites you don't expect to find so much. Anyway, in the year 2005, the excavators, a team from the Pittsburgh Union Theological Seminary, something like this, they found embedded in a wall, which is very interesting, a 38-pound limestone boulder with two lines of incised letters on one side, and then on the other was this sort of hollowed out bowl-like depression. Now the incisions were very light, and certainly writing on stone is not the easiest thing to write on, so there's got to be a reason here for this. Okay, so the inscription is known as and this is how it's pronounced in English. It's called an ABCdery, which is just like it sounds, an ABC, and that just means an alphabetic inscription. Because you have to think back even when the alphabet was invented. I mean, somebody had to come up with the order of all the letters, and that's basically a teaching tool, right? If we don't know, because if you try to teach someone the letters and you don't have an alphabetic song or whatever to go with it, it's quite possible you'll forget some of the letters to teach somebody. So it seems that there is a, just the human mind works better if we have it written out. So before we look at the actual text, I'll just tell you that the importance of the discovery is twofold. One was that it was found in a very good archaeological context, and that means it's very good for dating purposes. We know exactly it dates to the mid-10th century. So this is the time of when Shlomo is the king. And then the other thing is that it's very important for the development of the alphabet, because we have a complete kind of alphabetic text. The other very interesting thing about it was the fact that it was put in the wall and that it would not have really been visible from you know, any kind of a distance, which does suggest that even early on, the alphabet may have had some kind of apotropaic powers, you know, that this power to ward off evil spirits. And so there was a sort of a magical reason why to write the alphabetic inscription and put it in the wall, the idea that it would sort of protect the city as part of its defense systems. Okay, but for our purposes here, we're interested in it as a linear alphabet. So I would suggest you take out your pencils. Now's a good time, because we're going to go through the letters. And you'll see it is actually written from right to left, which very early on had not been really standardized. We find early Hebrew texts, early Canaanite texts that are written from left to right, from right to left, and then another system which the name is sort of like as a cow plows, which is that they would go from one direction, get to the end of the line, go down, and then go back in the other direction and go down. So, you know, it was, but in this case, it's a little easier for us because you can see it happens to be written from right to left. Okay, so let's kind of start. And we'll, this part I'm going to sort of help you with. I'm going to tell you kind of the answer, but when we get to the Gezer calendar, you're going to be on your own. Okay, so we're going to start on the left, and the first letter that you see there, no, I'm sorry, we're going to start on the right. Oh, see, I'm just making sure you're paying attention. Okay, so we're going to start on the right, and the very first letter is actually an aleph. Okay, so that helps us. It's good to know. And what you're going to see is, the order you're going to see is mostly the same, but there'll be a few differences here. Okay, so the first letter is an aleph. And by the way, each one of these goes back to a Hebrew or a Canaanite word. We don't know 100% about them, but we have a pretty good sense. So the aleph is like the ox head or something. The second letter is a bet. People say it was the shape of a house or of a tent or something like that. The third letter you see is a gimel. No, we're doing the top. That's very top. Yeah. So we're going to start at the very top. So you have aleph, bet, gimel, then you have dalet, then you have dalet. It's a little bit like a triangle. Yeah. Then the thing that looks like a hook is a vav. Yeah, it looks like a Y. Yeah, exactly. That's a vav. That's a vav. Okay, then the next letter is the hey. So you can see it's a little bit out of our order. So you have, in this case, vav before hey. We have a few other alphabetic inscriptions, and this is the only instance where you have this order. So it's kind of idiosyncratic. Then after the hey, again, we have something out of order. That's the chet. Looks a little bit like a ladder. Chet. Then you have Zion. So you have the chet before Zion. Then the next one that looks like a wagon wheel, that's a tet. Followed by a yud. And then we have another thing out of order. The next one is a lamed. It's supposed to be a shepherd's crook. Yeah, looks like a U. It's supposed to be a shepherd's crook, they say. Then you have a cuff, which looks like a hand, all with three fingers, a three-fingered hand. And then it looks... No, cuff. Cuff. Not kuf. Not kuf, cuff. Then you see there's a space. It's almost as if the person realized that they made a mistake. Oh dear, the lamed should have gone there. But anyway, then the next letter, it looks like it's supposed to represent water, is the mem. And then you have nun, which looks a little bit like an N. Followed by samach. Looks like an old antenna, is the samach. And then we have one more out of order, and it was interesting. When this inscription was first published, the headline in the New York Times said, ancient inscription found E before F. I mean, F before E, sorry, it said F before E. I was thinking, F before E, what on earth does that mean? So what it means is, pay before iron. Okay, so the next letter is pay. And then it's followed by ayin, which is supposed to be an I. And then the long thing is a tzadi. Then you have to go to the second line. And now the rest is all in order. So you have a kuf, a resh, which represented a head, a shin, which was supposed to be teeth, and then the last letter is a tuff. All right, so now you've just read the Tel Zayit ABCdery. So keep that, because then our next step is to see those same letters in the Gezer calendar. So one thing just... Okay, so I'm going to repeat it. I'll just kind of go through the letters, but I'm going to start with Aleph, okay? So we're going to repeat it. Okay, so it's Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Vav, He, Chet, Zion, Tet, Yud, Lamed, Kaf, Mem, Nun, Samech, Pei, Ayin, Tzadi, then on the second line, Kuf, Resh, Shin, Tuf. And I will also tell you that this, what we've just done as a instructor and as a lecturer here, you can kind of only do this at Yeshiva University. I couldn't do this in a regular college because the kids don't know Hebrew. And it didn't even occur to me until I actually tried to do this exercise with some students on the excavation who are non-Yeshiva University students on the excavation. They were all very eager to learn, but it was sort of like, oh gosh, first I have to teach them the Hebrew alphabet, then I'm going to have to teach them this. So we do this in class, and the kids can get it right away. So this is nice. Just a note about the pay before ayin. That is actually a very well-attested variation of the Hebrew alphabet. And in fact, I challenge you next time during the reading of Eicha, when you're sitting there and looking at the text, you'll see that some of the acrostics in Eicha will have the pay before the ayin. So it seems that was just a variant that, you know, had people were familiar with during the time. I'm sorry. Okay. I'll just... Is there a clarification or... Okay, so now we're going to get to the letters on the bottom. Okay, so the letters on the bottom are the letters that are found in the Gezer calendar. Now, this is not an ABCdery, meaning somebody hasn't gone and written all the letters out. And so just like you could write an English paragraph that doesn't have every letter of the English alphabet, that's what happens with the Gezer calendar. So a few letters are missing, not because they didn't know the letters, it's just because the inscription didn't require those particular letters. Okay, so for comparative purposes, let's go down now and we'll write out what the letters of the Gezer calendar are. So again, this is now on the bottom, and you're going to start with the Aleph there on the right. So you have Aleph, then you have Bet. Okay, there is no Gimel. So the next letter that's a triangle is a Dalet. And by the way, they're in the proper order now. Our order, I should say. Then the next letter is Vav, because there is no Hey. Vav, Zion, and Chet. There is no Tet. Then we have Yud, Kuf, Lamed, Mem. We skip the Nun. Then everything else. Samech, Ayin, Pei, Tzadi, Kuf, Resh, Shin, Tuf. Okay, so keep that. And then I suggest you kind of rip off the last sheet. We'll get to that in a moment. But we'll do a little more background first. Just one more thing about the idiosyncratic ordering of the Telzait at ABCDRI. While I said the Vav before He is without parallel, the Chet before Zion was also found in another ABCDRI inscription that was from a site called Itz Bet Sarta, which is pretty close to Gaza today. But the most well attested of those differences is the Pe before Ayin. Okay, now we'll get to the Gezer calendar. So, as I sort of overheard Rabbi Brander say earlier, he was talking about the inscription in the Siloam inscription and how that is at the museum in Istanbul. So the same is for the Gezer calendar, actually. If you want to see the original Gezer calendar, you need to go to Istanbul. And really, it's because the calendar was found in the early part of the 20th century. Remember, there was no state of Israel. It was the land of Israel was part of the Ottoman Empire, and this was standard practice. Anywhere in the empire, you know, if you found anything really cool, they sent it back to the capital city. So that's just sort of how a lot of these things ended up in Istanbul. Okay, so also if you go back to the map, you can see where Gezer is. It's a little bit further to the north, but it's also in the foothills region. So that's just interesting because it's in this border region. And what we see is in the early, you know, if you're talking about the time of King Solomon, that it, you know, it's very important for a new kingdom to define its borders, and particularly vis-a-vis the Philistines. And so what we see is that there clearly was administrators in these small border settlements. You had scribes. You probably even had schools that were, you know, scribal schools teaching people how to learn to read and to write. And this was part of building the new nation. And so. At Gezer, they found an inscription that, when it was found, it was known as one of the oldest Hebrew inscriptions. Since then, we have found other ones, including the Telzait ABCDRI. But nevertheless, this one is probably from, while the Telzait one is from the mid-10th century, this is from the late 10th century, so about a generation or so later. So I'm not even going to tell you what it's about, because I don't want to spoil your translation. We will certainly go over what it's about. But I'll just mention, so it was excavated by a British archaeologist named McAllister, who was a very productive archaeologist, but kind of a lousy archaeologist. So fortunately, he actually found this and didn't just throw it away. So he found this inscription, and as you'll see, it was incised also into limestone, and limestone is relatively soft, so it's an easy stone to inscribe into. And it was, with the knowledge that you now have of the Kitab Ivri, you are able to read it. And so it was not difficult for the people, the archaeologists, and for the kind of philologists to read the inscription. So I'm going to give you a few minutes, probably 5 to 10 minutes, and I really want you to try. You have now the letters in front of you, and if you go to that next page, you'll see a nice color copy of the Gezer calendar. So, by the way, if you see the Gezer calendar at the Israel Museum, that's a copy, right? Because the real one, as I said, was in Istanbul. They also have a copy at the site of Gezer itself. Okay, and it's not that big. I mean, the whole thing, it's about this big. It's about this big, the inscription. And you have it. I'll get you started on the first letter. Again, this one, the top and the bottom are the same. One's a drawing and one's a kind of a photograph. So they are the same. I think the drawing is probably a little easier to look at. But the letters are very clear. This isn't one. Sometimes you find inscriptions and there's a lot of kind of poetic license taken into the interpretation because the letters are so hard to read. This is not the case here. This one, the letters, I think, are quite clear. Or maybe it was just one or two exceptions. It's easily readable. Now, the first letter is a little bit obscured. It's all the way to the right. I'll just give you a hint to get you started. That's a yud. Now, the other thing to warn you about is a couple things. One is they don't leave spaces between words. That was kind of later on that was discovered. And the other thing is that also it wasn't important to, if you were writing a word and you came to the end of the tablet but you hadn't finished the word, that was okay. You just continued the word on the next line. Okay, so just kind of know about that. Right, no hyphen, you just kind of keep writing the word. Okay, and you'll start to see some patterns because the inscription is repetitive. Do you have a question? Oh, that's a good question. About the ABCdery, it wasn't written on a straight line. It is written kind of on a curve. And it could possibly, again, be getting back to the purpose of that inscription, which it doesn't seem to have been a teaching tool because it's very lightly scratched. It seems more to be related to sort of this magical properties of the alphabet. And it may have been that the stone was already embedded in the wall and somebody was just kind of like sitting down and they just, you know, they didn't have lined paper and they just kind of wrote it. But again, there wasn't this sense of, you know, it wouldn't have made it onto an Apple product because it didn't have the sense of aesthetics or that you had to finish everything on a single line. You know, I mean, to our eye, it's kind of annoying. Why not just finish the whole thing on one line? Why have five letters on the second line? But that clearly didn't bother them. Okay. All right. So I gave you the first letter is a yud. That's all I'm going to tell you. What I would suggest is you write the letters over and then try to work on the translation afterwards. They are going to make words, yes. Some, and you'll see, many of the words you'll be familiar with. All right, so, and if you have, I can walk around the room if you have particular questions, otherwise I just want to give you the... Oh, okay, so there is a vertical line in the drawing that is kind of just very faint in the photograph and you can't see it. That is a word separator, but they're not consistent with that. So don't look for it all the time. It's just a vertical line. I think I see two of them. I only see one on the first line and one on the second line. And then also on line one, two, three, four, on line five, it appears to be a letter underneath the mem there. Don't worry about that letter. That's not part of our inscription. It's going to be easier if you work with the Gezer calendar alphabet. Yeah, and you can see that the letters changed even within a generation or two. The font a little bit changed. It evolves. And then you always have to take into account just the way, you know, personal writing, whereas just like there's two of us don't have the same writing. Yes, there's a lot of repetition. That's what makes it a little easier to to transcribe. So while you're still working on it, I'll just give you a little background of the interpretation. Is that you see there's a lot of repetition, and particularly the word yerach, which is the word for month here, related to yereach. That's why it's called the Gezer calendar. We're not sure what this really was originally. It could be just a schoolboy exercise, where somebody's writing down kind of maybe either just an exercise or maybe it's some kind of a folk song. Another interpretation is that this was actually something that the tax collector used, so he knew exactly when to show up in order to collect certain taxes. I guess it's sort of where you fall out there. All right, shall we begin? Okay, so we'll start on the first line. I think what we'll do is we'll kind of go through it. We'll read the letters and we'll translate it kind of line by line. All right. So yes, it's called the calendar because it's talking about the months, and it's basically similar to the song. You know, like Monday is wash day, Tuesday is cooking day, Wednesday is sewing day, that kind of thing. All right. So here it goes. So the first four letters are actually Yarchu. And you have this very weird, the vav is, it's something that's archaic that we clearly don't have anymore, but it was a verb kind of doubling form, referring to the noun. So it's kind of talking about a double month, kind of like, it's double month, that's Yarchu. So it's a 2 month period. Okay, so the first thing is, and when we see, we'll actually get 12 months because this is a certain number of double months and then a certain number of single months. Okay, so his double month, it's Yarchu. So it's Yud, Resh, Chet, Vav is the first word. And that means his double month, Yarchu. And then the next word is, does anybody know? Asaf, exactly. So his double month is in gathering, right? Like Asaf, okay? Very good, yes. So it's probably, starting with Tishrei, sort of like the September, October, kind of those 2 months. And what were they gathering? At that point, they're gathering in both the olives and the grapes. Okay, so in those 2 months, you have the Asaf, and that's the referring to the harvest of the olives and the grapes. And of course, it makes sense that you would start this kind of poem with this, because these are the two most the wheat and barley obviously are very important for calories, but wine and oil are the two main exports of the land of Israel. They'll be the most important, they're the most profitable products, and the biggest market, even by this time, already thousands of years prior to this time, the biggest market for the oil and the wine is Egypt. Basically, Egypt cannot grow these products except in a very few places because it requires a certain chill in the air for olives and grapes to mature, and it just doesn't get cold enough in Egypt. So the biggest market then is Egypt, but they were shipping it all, even other places as well. So it's the oil and they weren't so interested in olives and grapes. What they wanted was the oil and the wine. And the oil, by the way, people get confused and think of, as oil is so central to the Mediterranean diet and it's a great thing, to have olive oil. They were not eating a lot of olive oil back then. You could use it, but it didn't stay. It would kind of go bad very quickly. So if you wanted to use it in cooking, you had to use it within the first couple weeks. Mostly when they cooked and they wanted fat, they used animal fat. The oil is being used for fuel, for light. That's mostly what it's being used for, which is the most important. And that's all those lamps. Those are all olive oil lamps. I'm sorry? Oh, good question. Is this a Philistine or a Jewish calendar? Because you're right on the border. So this is considered a Jewish calendar. This is written in Hebrew. So, later on, we'll see the Philistines actually adopt the Hebrew alphabet as well. They sort of, they bring with them kind of the Cypro-Minoan writing system, but then they stop using it. Okay, so the first thing is his double month is in gathering. We got that Yarchu Asaf, and that is September and October. Then it repeats Yarchu, right? So his double month. And then you have the Zion on the first line, and then it continues on to the line two, is Zerah. Okay, so his double month is, right, exactly, is planting. And so this would be like November. And what do you plant in November? Exactly. In the land of Israel, unlike, say, Alberta, this is when you plant the wheat and the barley. So as you can see, farmers don't get a lot of vacation time. You kind of bring everything in and you have all the chagim and it's great. And then November comes, once the rains have come and softened the ground a little bit, then you already are out plowing and seeding. Okay, so that takes you to November. So we have November and December, because again, that's a double month. So you have Yarchu Zerah. Then you have that little line telling you it's a word separator. Then we get another double month, Yarchu. And in this case, it's we could read it as Lachish or Lekish, something like this. And that is, Lekish is probably referring to the late rains. And those are the rains that really kind of get, you know, not just, they soak the ground. They're the ones that get the plants really going. And so that's referring to his 2 months are late planting and all the activities associated with sort of this late, you know, you gotta get all your legumes in. And so that's the late planting. So that was January and February. So now you've gotten through 6 months. Then we go to a single month. So you have Yerach. We're on line three now. You have Yerach Atzad Peshet. Okay? And Pishta, does anybody know what that is? Flax, exactly. And the Matzad is related probably to the word for an axe. And so this was the time for chopping the flax. Okay? And what flax was used, you had flax seed oil, you could get something like that, but also the flax was used for linen. So it wasn't just food that you're eating. Okay, so that takes you up to March. That was the time when you chopped down the flax. So yeah, it's 1 month. Yerach Atzad Peshat. Oh, Atzad, so you have Ayin, Sadi, Dalet, and then Pei, Shin, Tuf. All right, then you can go to line four. And you have Yerach, again, Kitsar, Sa'aram. So it's Yerach, just like this a single month. So this is the month. Kitsar is to harvest. So that's a month of harvest. And Sa'aram, you have that as a shin, an ayin, a resh, and a mem. And so the mem is like a little bit misaligned. So that's the month of the barley harvest, which is basically in April, and that's associated with the holiday of Pesach, exactly. So that's now you're in April. So you have the month of the barley harvest. And barley, even though you plant the wheat and the barley at the same time, barley, just by its nature, it ripens earlier. So that's why you start the harvest of the barley first, because it's ripe first. You're not going to harvest the wheat yet, because it's not ripe. Okay, so now we go to, the next line, 1, 2, 3, line five. And you have, again, a single month. It says Yerach Kitsar again, so you have a month of harvesting. And then it Oh, it is a chet, sorry. It's just been kind of turned on its side. That's a, I know, that wasn't fair. I don't know why they did that. What? Yeah, very bad penmanship, exactly. Yeah, so it's the, yes. And you can see it, you can see when you look, if you look at the photograph, that it's been kind of like rotated almost 90 degrees, which is not very nice. Okay, so you have Yerach, Katsar again, and then a Vav, a Kaf, and a Lamed, so something like Ukal. So his month is harvest, and then the Ukal is, there's some debate about what that really means. Some say the root is Kul, meaning to contain or to hold. So a month of harvest and measuring. Some translations will even refer to that as feasting. But anyway, this is referring to the wheat harvest as opposed to the barley harvest. Then we get to I disregard that. I don't know why that was. You see, it's not really on the photograph. I don't know why that appears. It looks like it was probably an earlier writing that got kind of erased. Sometimes they would reuse the limestone for inscriptions, but it's not part of our inscription here. Okay, then again we go back to a double month. So anyway, by the way, we're up to May. That was the wheat harvest is in May. Yarchu Zemer this time. So his double month is, what's Zemer? Exactly, pruning. And what are they pruning? They're pruning the vines. This is for the grapevines. It's very important that you prune them, so to make sure that you maximize your grape harvest. So that's what you're doing in June and July. You're pruning your grapes. And by the way, even today, I mean, if you go to a vineyard, it smells so good at that time if you go starting June, July, and then, of course, at the harvest time. Okay, and then the last line before we get to the little bit that's diagonal, that's vertical, is Yerach Kites, meaning this is the month of summer fruit. And so that would be, you know, the dates and the figs and all that good stuff. Okay, and then at the bottom, you can see there's a little vertical inscription. You have to kind of turn it on its side, and we see probably the name of the person who wrote the inscription. His name is Avi, exactly. So, or Avia, maybe there was a hay that was cut off, probably. So there you have it. There you have the Gezer calendar that you all are able now to read, and we know we've met Avi or Avia who wrote this inscription. That was his homework. You did your homework. But anyway, just so you know, this inscription it's close to 3,000 years old. So you had a. Right, and what's amazing is that you can still read it. I mean, you know the Hebrew letters, it's just a different font. You learned that font, and now you can read it. And now the truth is you could read any Kitav Ivri inscription. This one's nice because the letters were like really pronounced, and like for example, the Siloam inscription that Rabbi Brander mentioned earlier, I mean, it's just a lot more dense, and people just kind of look at it and go, oh no, but you know what? It's the exact same process. You just very slowly kind of find each letter, make it so that it's easier for you to read, and you would be able to read that as well. Okay, so I'm going to end here for those of you who want to leave, but I'll take some questions. Yeah. Okay, so the Dead Sea Scrolls are mostly written in the Kitav Ashuri. There's a few that are written in Aramaic, and as I mentioned, sometimes they would use the Kitav Ivri to write the name of Hashem. So the first time they found this, so they kind of recognized the letters already because they had found already, it's very similar, all these alphabets, the Canaanite alphabet, the Hebrew alphabet, they're all very similar. Oh, the first time, if you haven't found anything like this, then you would have to, you know, what you have to do is you have to identify, figure out first of all what language it is, and then, you know, when you try to decipher these things, I mean, I think you could tell right away without knowing anything that this is an alphabetic inscription because there's so few signs. If an inscription of this length that wasn't alphabetic, you'd have a lot more signs. So you know it's an alphabetic inscription, and then yeah, that, it becomes very tricky to try to decide. I mean, fortunately, we never totally lost the continuity. Yeah. Okay, all right. So, oh yeah, one more question. Okay, so question was about the Tel El Amarna letters. The Tel El Amarna letters were a group of letters that are written in cuneiform that were found in Egypt a little bit earlier. They're from the late Bronze Age period, so they're about 300 to 400 years earlier. And what's interesting is they're from Egypt, but they're written in Akkadian because at that point, Akkadian was the lingua franca. And so if an Egyptian pharaoh wanted to communicate with his vassals in the land of Israel or with the king of the Hittites or the Babylonians, he had to do so in Akkadian, and so he had Akkadian scribes that were brought to his cities in order to do so. Yes, before Aramaic was widely adopted by the Assyrians, it was Akkadian was the universal language of communication. And it was much more difficult. All right, thank you very much.